Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. What year was it? The government, while not prohibiting religious instruction, began to regulate the instruction. The principles of the state were substituted for any doctrines from the Bible in public school education. Prayer, which had been an obligatory part of the school openings, was stopped by the state. What year was it? Christmas was turned into a social festival. Christmas carols and nativity plays were banned from the schools. The name of Christmas was changed to Yuletide. Crucifixes were no longer allowed in public classrooms. Easter was changed into a holiday that proclaimed the beginning of spring. What year was it? The first set of actions took place in 1935. The second set of actions took place in 1938. Both took place in Nazi Germany under the direction of Adolf Hitler. District Judge John Woodcock denied a request from Bangor Christian Schools, which would have allowed the school to accept public tuition assistance for any Christian students attending the school. After the United States Supreme Court struck down Maine's 40-year ban on giving public funds to religious schools, the Maine legislature quickly amended the state's anti-discrimination laws to include gender discrimination. The state is saying that if you want our money, you must play by our rules. You must worship a culturally acceptable God to enjoy the benefits of the culture. It is the carrot and stick of government. The carrot is public money, our taxpayer money, but the stick is you must deny your religious values to get it. Daniel's challenge in 600 BC speaks relevantly to our challenge in AD 2024. I think we see in Daniel 2 what I call the pagan deal. We will respect your God if you respect our gods. That's the pagan deal. We will respect your God if you respect our gods. Let's take a look at this challenge because it is subtle and powerful. The church in Germany in the 1930s faced the same challenge that we face today. It is the challenge of a culturally acceptable God. You can be successful if you honor the gods of our culture and keep your faith private. The world says, "We will respect your God," verses 46 to 49 in Daniel chapter 2. Listen to the words. "Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, 'Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery.' Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon, while Daniel was at the king's court. What a picture! This tyrant, who only moments before was ordering the execution of all his top counselors in the kingdom, was now lying prostrate before the captive from the tiny country of Judah. He showers worship on Daniel and on Daniel's God. Notice what he says. Surely your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. It must have been a very uncomfortable experience for Daniel, knowing that God deserved the glory, not him, yet this king was bowing before him. Daniel recognized, of course, that Nebuchadnezzar was also giving credit to God by giving credit to Daniel. And this is often the way it is with pagans. They cannot see the invisible God, but they can see us. So when pagans want to respect our God, they may do so by showering praise on us and through us on our God. And the king goes on to shower riches, fame, and position on Daniel. He rewards him greatly for his interpretation of the dream. Back in Daniel 2, verse 6, the king had promised wealth and honor to the one who could reveal his dream. So he is following through on that promise with Daniel. Yet he goes way beyond his original promise. He makes Daniel the civil governor of the province of Babylon and the chief of appointed officials in the court. This was an incredible position of power. In modern terms, Daniel was the equivalent of the president's chief of staff and mayor of Washington, D.C., all in one position. Daniel, of course, uses his authority to get his three friends appointed to high-ranking positions as well. Imagine the incredible change from captive slaves only a few years earlier to high-ranking government positions in the most powerful nation in the Middle East. It is precisely at this point that all believers must watch out. We must ask, what is the price tag? What is the price tag? I am sure Daniel was wondering where this was all going, even as he accepted the promotion and the honor and the power. Don't assume from this passage that Nebuchadnezzar had been converted. He was just as pagan as before. The king was a true polytheist. Polytheism has no problem honoring our God because, well, all gods deserve to be worshipped. The king was simply acknowledging that Daniel's God was one of the many gods that he worshipped. Polytheists want to make sure that they cover all their bases so that they don't offend anyone else's God. But the king certainly did not recognize God as the only true God of the universe. Religious polytheists in modern America function just like polytheists in the ancient world. Everybody's God is equal, and everybody's God is to be equally respected and honored. But here's the catch. We will respect your God, but religion belongs to the private sphere. As long as you worship your God in private, we will be glad to honor your God too. Nebuchadnezzar was only too happy to worship Daniel's God in private. You can hold powerful positions, you can handle government responsibilities, but keep your religion private. You can be successful in life if you play by our rules. Christians in Nazi Germany in the 1930s were caught in the same pagan deal. They became dependent on the federal government for their prosperity. As long as they kept their faith private and towed the party line in public, then they were rewarded with good jobs, money for their churches, and even government positions. Adolf Hitler was only too glad to speak well of Christians and churches that supported him in Germany. He publicly encouraged those clergy who used their positions to support his plans and his goals and his agenda. And he made sure that those churches and those people enjoyed wealth and power and influence in the country of Germany in the 1930s. There were, however, many Christians who rejected the pagan deal in Nazi Germany. They became known as the Confessing Church because they usually lost their jobs, and many pastors were arrested for speaking out against the state. Many were removed from their church positions. In 1941, the Confessing Church issued a statement that raised serious concerns about the state and its control of the church. The document ended with these words, which sound ominously like parts of America today. The state excludes the church from everything which it considers as belonging to the political sphere. At the same time, the church is expected to shrivel up into nothing, they wrote. That's the pagan deal. We will respect your God if you respect our gods. Daniel 3, verses 1 through 7. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sounds of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, this great orchestra, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Nebuchadnezzar shows us his true polytheism in these verses. He also teaches us the corollary of the principle of respect that the state wants to push. Religion belongs to the private sphere. The state belongs to the public sphere. He was demanding loyalty for himself. And without that loyalty, without that pledge of loyalty, horrible repercussions would come to the person who stood up against him, who did not give him complete loyalty. We do not know how many years elapsed between the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. Most scholars estimate that this chapter takes place probably about a dozen years after the events of chapter 2. This would make the events coincide with the fall and burning of Jerusalem in 586 BC. There was considerable political unrest in the empire during these years. A number of nations revolted, and the king had to send armies to put down these revolts. Jerusalem revolted twice during the years that Daniel was serving in the king's court. The first time, the king put down the revolt, but left the nation intact. He carried off some more captives, and he took some more treasures from the temple. The prophet Ezekiel, for example, was one of the captives in this second invasion. Finally, in 586 BC, the king looted and burned the city of Jerusalem to the ground. All of this was going on while Daniel continued to be active in the king's court back in Babylon. Can you imagine how difficult it was for Daniel and his friends to serve in a pagan administration that was attacking and destroying their homeland and the city of Jerusalem and the temple and hauling off captives? People were suffering and dying. It must have been very hard for them not to hate Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians as word came to them through new captives of the sufferings and heartaches of their people, their families back in Jerusalem. With all the political unrest in the empire, it's no wonder that the king decided to test the loyalty of his empire by building this great statue and requiring the leaders of all the provinces of the empire to assemble and swear their allegiance to him and to the state. So Nebuchadnezzar built this great image as a demand of loyalty. It's most likely a human image. We assume it is meant to symbolize him. The statue is 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, built in the plain of Dura, a few miles outside the city of Babylon. Many scholars have pointed out that a human image 90 feet by 9 feet would be grotesquely skinny, and for that reason many suggest that the 90 feet, the height, included a huge platform on which the actual image stood. Archaeologists, a number of years ago, discovered a mound a few miles outside of Babylon that was 45 feet square and 20 feet high, which could have been the base of some ancient structure like this image. The king issued an edict that required the leaders of all his provinces to assemble for the dedication of the image. These men represented all the people of the kingdom. They stood before the image, and the herald made the proclamation. To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. The public sphere belongs to the state. Swear your allegiance to the state. Give your allegiance to the king, to the president, to the dictator. There is no authority higher than the state. As long as you can acknowledge the supreme authority of the state, then you can worship whatever personal gods you want in the privacy of your own provinces and your own homes. That is the message of Nebuchadnezzar and the image that Nebuchadnezzar set up to demand this loyalty. It was also the message of Nazi Germany, and subtly seems to be growing as the message of modern America. Religion belongs in the private sphere. The state belongs in the public sphere. In a chapter entitled When the State Becomes God, John Lennox writes about two parallel but opposite trends that we can observe in the world of power politics. Even though there is a drive to relativize absolutes, men and women cannot live without them. So, they eventually take something of relative value and absolutize it. That is, they regard it as the core value that determines their attitude to everything else. From time immemorial, the obvious candidates have been the state, power, wealth, and sex. They absolutize the relatives. We see the deification of the state and power in Daniel 3. The state absolutizes the relative and relativizes the absolute in order to achieve the goal of the state to exert power over religion, to control faith. Loyalty to the state, or loyalty to a government leader, a president, or a political party, must take precedence over the public exercise of our faith. Let me summarize. Here's the pagan deal. We will respect your God if you respect our gods. The corollary of that deal is this. Religion belongs in the private sphere. The state belongs in the public sphere. We can have our God as long as he is culturally acceptable. So what are we to do with that deal as Christians? Let me articulate God's answer to that deal. We will see that answer played out in the lives of Daniel's three friends. For now, let me simply explain the Christian response and apply the principle to our lives today. The Christian commitment: deny the lie and prove your faith. That's the Christian commitment. Deny the lie and prove your faith. Christianity is an exclusive faith because Christ is the exclusive God. Believers, since the time of Daniel, could not and cannot buy into the pagan deal. God is not one among many gods that deserve equal place in the pantheon of the world. Neither can Christianity be marginalized to the private sphere of our lives. As the saying goes, he is Lord of all or not Lord at all. Leslie Newbegin, a British missionary statesman, wrote, "Of course, as contemporary history proves, Christians can live and bear witness under any regime, whatever its ideology. But Christians can never seek refuge in a ghetto where their faith is not proclaimed as public truth for all. Christians can never agree that there is one law for themselves and another law for the world. Whatever the institutional relationship between the church and the state, the church can never cease to remind governments that they are under the rule of Christ and that he alone is the judge of all they do. Every government, every president is under the rule of Christ ultimately. They will be accountable to God." So, my friends, our first response to the pagan deal is to deny the lie of the two spheres. We must reject the pagan deal. We must never accept the principle that our faith is merely tolerated in our private spheres. What we believe in our homes is what we believe on our jobs. The God we worship in our churches is the God we worship in the courtroom. The highest authority in the land is neither the federal government nor the Supreme Court of the United States of America. The highest authority in the land, indeed of the world, is Christ. In May of 1934, the Confessing Church in Germany published a document that became known as the Barmen Confession. This document denied the state's mandate that they acknowledge Christ as Lord only over the spiritual sphere instead of worshiping a Christ who was Lord of all. At the end of the Barmen Confession is this statement: "We reject the false doctrine that there are realms of our life in which we belong not to Jesus Christ, but to other masters, realms where we do not need to be justified and sanctified by Him. That's the Christian commitment. Many would give and have given their lives for that commitment. Years ago, I was performing my responsibilities as a citizen by serving on jury duty. I remember one particular moment in that month of jury duty. I had been selected to serve as an alternate in a civil case. The judge gathered us in the courtroom. He sat on a high bench at one end of the massive courtroom, and we sat in rows of chairs at the other end. He lectured us on our civic responsibilities. At one point, he reminded us that we were there to uphold the laws of this country and state, whether we agreed with those laws or not. And he raised this question, because that was fine as far as it went. But then he raised this question. Is there anyone on this jury who believes that there is a higher authority than the laws of this land? Is there anyone on this jury who believes that there is a higher authority than the laws of this land? And he paused for about 10 seconds. My mind tried to process what he was saying in what was a very intimidating setting. At first, I thought it was a rhetorical question, but he paused long enough to make me realize that he might be inviting a response. I did not respond. Perhaps I was intimidated by the situation. Perhaps I needed time to process the question. I look back on that moment as a moment of shame, actually, that I did not stand up and say, "I do, and His name is Jesus Christ. Your authority and the authority of this country are derived authorities, and my first loyalty is to Jesus Christ as the higher authority." I wish I had stood up, but I didn't. I remained seated, and he continued his lecture. But I also look back on that moment as a moment of truth. I think, for the first time in my life, I realized how dangerous political and judicial authority can be, even in a democracy. My friends, loyalty to the state cannot supplant loyalty to God. It's that simple. So deny the lie of the two spheres and prove your faith by your faithfulness. Erwin Lutzer, in his book Hitler's Cross, wrote these words of warning to us American Christians today. The church overlooked the fact that the fight against Nazism was essentially not political, but spiritual. The church mistook the temporal benefits of the swastika for the spiritual benefits of the cross of Christ. Wanting to believe that Hitler was the answer, it forgot what the really important questions were. We face the same danger today. Believers in Germany became dependent on the government for their prosperity. They owed their loyalty to Hitler and the Nazis. And we are in the same danger today. We dare not trade the spiritual benefits of the cross for the economic benefits of the state. Like Esau, who sold his birthright for a pot of stew, we can sell our spiritual integrity for political position, economic prosperity, or government favors. When the Iron Curtain fell, the countries of Eastern Europe were free to worship for the first time in many years. Thousands of believers gathered in the churches of Leipzig, Dresden, and Wittenberg to worship God freely and openly. The church had survived communism and refused to bow the knee to Karl Marx, Johann Richter, pastor of St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, looked back on the experience this way. Richter said, we didn't encourage disobedience, the responsibility would have been too great. What we did was encourage obedience to God. We said, do you want to be free and obey the Ten Commandments? Or do you want to be a slave and have a car and a good job? Wow. Do you want to be free and obey God? Or do you want to be a slave and have a car and a good job? They didn't encourage disobedience. The cost was too high. They encouraged obedience and loyalty to God first. The same question could be asked of Christians in America and around the world today. I must share with you a deep concern I have for American Christianity. Here's my concern. We will sell out our loyalty to Christ for success in our society. We will sacrifice the gospel on the altar of political clout. The battle between our Christian worldview and a pagan worldview is being fought over many issues, such as marriage, family, human sexuality, abortion, euthanasia, faith-based charities, government subsidies for educational institutions, and taxation of churches and religious properties, among others. All of these issues, and many more, we will face increasingly in the days ahead. I see Christians tending to walk in one of two paths, both of which miss the heart of Christ and the example of Daniel. The first path is the path of private faith. Many Christians have adopted the principle of allowing culture to go its way and settling for personal faith in private settings like family and church. We'll have our own things, our own programs. We can have the financial support of the government for our nonprofit organization if we don't talk about Christianity out there in public. The church can be tax-free as long as she accepts the separation of the church from the state. We can teach in schools or have our own or work in government as long as we check our Christianity at the door. We can worship Christ as long as we agree that all gods are to be equally respected. But this, my friends, is an abdication of our faith. We compromise the power of the gospel when we shrink into our Christian ghettos and avoid confronting the culture around us. When we focus our attention only on inside the church, and we don't serve and work in jobs out there, in government and other places, and share our faith and live out with integrity what we believe. The second path is the path of political power. It is the opposite path. Many Christians become transactional. We will vote for an immoral candidate because he will give us power and influence in the government. Character doesn't matter as long as we get what we want in the bargain. If we gain power by supporting candidates who will protect our rights and pass moral laws, we will transform our country because we will have the power. So we sell our testimony for political clout. We warp our witness for government favors. My friends, our task is not political, and the solutions are not political. As Chuck Colson used to say, transformed lives transform society. Daniel shows us that way. For he lived with integrity while serving well in the government of an immoral world. But we compromise our faith when we buy into the idea that we can redeem society through legislative agendas. Daniel shows us a third path. It is the path of integrity, the path of quiet courage, of excellence with integrity. He didn't lead protests over what Babylon was doing to Israel. Daniel didn't try to manipulate the power brokers to get his laws passed. Daniel did his job well, and lived with integrity, serving multiple administrations of a pagan government. Highly respected, he understood that God was building his kingdom, which was not to be confused with the Babylonian Empire. He served well, but he lived his faith in God. If the government will subsidize our school, our college, our food ministry, but we cannot share the gospel, what's the price tag? We are free to serve a culturally acceptable God. No. We must deny the lie that our faith can be bought for financial success and political clout. We must deny that our faith can be limited to the private sphere. It permeates all of life, or it is not Christianity. We must live it with excellence. We must take opportunities to show that Christianity is not like all other religions. We must stand for Christian principles and apply Christian thinking to the moral and social issues of our day. Christianity is an exclusive faith because Christ is an exclusive God. We can sing and pledge our allegiance to our country as long as we remember that God is the final authority.